Thanks to you all for taking the time to attend the talk today, which will focus on Africa and the ICC, which is an important topic, mostly because Africa, more than any other continent, has been targeted by the ICC proceedings, which is used sometimes by those who are targeted by the ICC as a sort of double standard and some sort of exceptionalism, meaning people like al-Bashir, Charles Taylor will be targeted, and someone like Bush will not be touched by the ICC and these kind of international for crime that could be also similar. I mean, this led to a lot of debate within the African continent, specifically about the balance between punishment and between justice and achieving peace in places where this has been a question, especially in Sudan, whether to try al-Bashir, who's a standing president, which is unprecedented, or to really the necessity of keeping him in power because he is a partner to the conflict and an important element in the debate. I guess these are some of the questions that I hope Professor Munandulu will help us understand as we discuss this very difficult topic, because it is a heated debate across Africa as we people move from dictatorship wars into zones of reconciliation. So truce and reconciliation is one aspect of commission, like in South Africa, is one aspect of addressing crimes against humanity under apartheid. I guess the case of Charles Taylor, we know he was extradited and he's now tried in The Hague. I'm not the speaker, so I'm just gonna go ahead and introduce our speaker today, who is Professor Munandulu, who is a professor of law at Cornell Law School and director of the Institute for African Development at Cornell University. He is also an honorary professor of law at the Faculty of Law, University of Cape Town in South Africa. Professor Ndule is a graduate of the University of Zambia, where he got his LLB, and from Harvard University, where he's got his LLM, and Trinity College in Oxford University, where he got his doctorate in philosophy of law. He was formerly professor and of law and the dean of the School of Law at the University of Zambia. He has extensive international and UN experience, having served as a legal officer in the international law branch of the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. He's a legal advisor and political advisor to United Nations Observer Mission in South Africa, United Nations Assistant Mission to East Timor, United Nations Mission to Kosovo, and United Nations Missions to Afghanistan. And you can see how really he is highly experienced in these areas, and his expertise was sought after by many organizations. He was appointed by the African Union to the AU high-level panel on Darfur, headed by former South African President Thabo Mbeki. He has published extensively, and his major area of interest include governance, economic development, international criminal law, and human rights. His most recent publications include Democratic Reforms in Africa, Its Impact on Governance and Poverty Alleviation, published by Ohio University Press, and also James Curry Publishers in London. Comparative Constitutionalism, that's another book, and Good Governance, an Eastern and Southern African Perspective, published by Cambridge University Press. And finally, and most recently, Gender, Power, and Social Change in Africa, Cambridge Scholars Publishers. I can go on and on listing really the expertise and credentials of Professor Muno, but I think it is time for us to hear the lecture itself. So please join me in welcoming Professor Munandulu.
Thank you very much for having me here and giving me this opportunity to discuss with you the ICC and Africa, what is obviously, as Professor Hassan has pointed out, a very topical issue right now in Africa, especially with regard to the indictment of Bashir. But I think to understand the international criminal process, we have to go back to Nuremberg. Because after the Second World War, you had the Nuremberg trials. Now, the Nuremberg trials were conducted under the London Agreement. So they actually set up a special court to do the trials. And then, of course, on the Eastern Front, you had the tribunals for the East. So I mentioned that because two things happened there, which actually have led to the development of the ICC. Because one is that during that period also, there was a development of the Genocide Convention, and there was discussion about creating a permanent court at that time. So there was this discussion, and the very much actually, interestingly, supported by the United States. During Nuremberg, it's important to make the point that the US was for trials, whereas if you look at the UK and Russia, they were for summary execution. They were saying, no, just kill these guys and it's over. But the US insisted that, no, we need a process. And that's what led to this creation of this. And as I say, there was at that point a discussion, but they could not agree, and they decided to have what they had, which was the Nuremberg trial, which was a special court. And then the second point to note about the Nuremberg trial was that it's the defense that was raised by the defendants was that they were acting on behalf of the state. You know, you could not put this on them. You know, that's, so the concept of individual responsibility was established then. You see, at Nuremberg, the judges said, we go behind the shell of the state and find out who actually has been directing this. And their reasoning was that if we don't do that, we'll never be able to punish or prevent wars or these kind of atrocities. And that's a very important point. So those two points emerge from Nuremberg, the question of individual responsibility as opposed to state. So it doesn't matter that it was a cabinet decision to say, let's do this. They are going to go after the people who attended that meeting, which decided on those atrocities. Now, this principle of individual responsibility was reaffirmed in the Pinochet trial. Because again, it came up in terms of Pinochet's role. Remember that Pinochet had actually gone for medical reasons to the UK. And of course, unknown to him, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International had actually prepared a warrant and a dossier, which of course they had filed with a judge in Spain. And then of course, he found himself arrested. So what was supposed to be a 1 week trip ended up being 2 or 3 years. Because then, of course, he started to fight for his freedom. Now, again there, if you look at the House of Lords decision, the judges there said, this question about individual responsibility is over. This is settled. From now onwards, you are responsible. We'll go behind the state and find out who in government was actually saying, we do this. Now, so coming now to the process of creating the International Criminal Court. Actually, the idea... after that, of course, the Cold War took over, so there was not much progress made in terms of trying to create the International Criminal Court. And then the idea is taken up again in 1989, actually, by Trinidad and Tobago. They're the ones that asked the General Assembly to consider setting up an international tribunal. Now, interestingly, Trinidad's idea was not really about the international crimes in terms of genocide, humanity. They were more concerned about drug trafficking. So they wanted an international court which would try those kinds of offenses because they felt that the dimensions of the offenses affected so many countries and that this should not be left to individual countries to try. Now, the General Assembly's position then in 1989 was to refer the matter to a body called the International Law Commission. Now, those of us who work in the international field, know about the International Law Commission. The International Law Commission is actually a body of top jurists in the field of international law. And they meet once a year in Geneva. And what they do is just sort of like brainstorm on things and come out with drafts about what kind of laws the world needs and all that. And then, of course, once they've concluded that process, they send it, you know, to either the General Assembly or a diplomatic conference, depending on how the system then evolves. And the International Law Commission is a very, very important body, actually, in terms of being a source of the international system. So if you look, for example, the Vienna Convention on Treaties, they're the ones that started that, and many, many, conventions, actually from them. And it's also the body where, actually, people are chosen to go to the ICJ. So you find that people who serve as judges on the ICJ, the trick is to get on the Law Commission first. Because from there, you know, it's easier. You know, they sort of like look at those as, yeah. So they go to this task. They ask them to come up with a draft on International Criminal Court. So they then made this draft, and the process went on for quite some time. And, of course, in the end, it culminated into the Rome Statute. So we then had this diplomatic conference in Rome, at which the International Criminal Law Statute was tabled. Now, I think it's important to mention, though, that while this process was going on, because there was no International Criminal Court, the Security Council, from time to time, established special courts. And here we're talking about Rwanda Tribunal, we're talking about Yugoslav Tribunal. They were all created by the Security Council. Now you might ask, under what power did they do that? The Security Council argues that they did that under Chapter 7, which is the use of force section of the UN Charter, and gives primary responsibility over issues of security to the Security Council. And the Security Council argues that if you look at that section, it says, they will take measures, you know, measures to bring about peace. And they claim that creating these courts, like in Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, was a measure towards creating peace. Now, you might argue with them and say they don't have jurisdiction to do this, so they shouldn't have been doing this. But that's why you have those courts, and that's the basis. That's the legal basis of those courts. And there are people who challenge that position and say, well, I don't think you should really have power to do that. So,
What year was the Rome Statute, and what year was the Security Council meetings?
Which one? No, the Rwanda. Well,
Rome Statute first.
Rome Statute. I'll pass it to my student. Rome Statute. What year was it? What year was it?
And,
I just want to be clear. I think it's 19. Which year exactly? 98, I think, around that.
98. So it was after that.
Definitely, as I say, just Trinidad raised the question. So.
But he has to have a chronological context.
Now, what I explained is that Trinidad and Tobago, in 1989, proposed to set up this International Criminal Court. So that's what happened. Now, I said the idea of Trinidad and Tobago was a drug court, not genocide and use. So then I said that in the this matter was given to a law commission. What was the law commission to do? So to develop the text. Because to create a court, you need the text, not the legislation. Yeah, legislation, which is this. You know, that's what they created. I mean, that's the statute. So this statute outlines what the court is, the powers of the court, and all sorts of things. So that's the role of the law commission. Once they were done with the draft, they then sent it to the Rome meeting. The Rome meeting is a diplomatic conference of all states meeting now to actually adopt. And when you adopt, then that's like legislation. That's how a treaty comes into force. So that's the process that went into this. So the significance of the Rome meeting was really like parliament. Because there's no world parliament, that's what they do. They create what is called diplomatic conference. If you don't do that, you can send it to the General Assembly. It's actually cheaper. Because then, of course, you use the framework of the General Assembly. Now, so I say that the International Criminal Court was then, of course, adopted. At the Rome meeting, the U.S. actually did not think that the statute would be adopted then. You see, they thought that there's still more work to be done. And then, you know, we'll come to why the U.S. Doesn't like the ICC and their legal arguments. I take the view that the U.S.'s legal arguments are not valid and that, in fact, they're just an excuse. But their position, of course, was that this will not take place because they still wanted to discuss the matter. Now, what's the difference between them and the others? The U.S. basically wanted more control, the control of the court by the Security Council. They wanted the Security Council to determine the agenda in terms of what cases go to the court. The other country said, no, why should we do that? Now, one of the reasons the other countries did not like the U.S. position is that, you see, without the court, we have a concept called universal jurisdiction. Universal jurisdiction is, I think you probably have heard it within the context of Belgium, what Belgium is doing. But under international law, every state in the world has jurisdiction to try an international crime. They don't need anybody's permission. So as long as you're going to try genocide, you're going to try crimes against humanity, you're going to try war crimes, you can do it. The reason why some countries do it and others don't is that, of course, courts in any country require domestic legislation to authorize them to do something. So the difference between Spain and the U.S. and Belgium and the U.S. is that Belgium and Spain have created that. They've legislated and allowed their courts to take universal jurisdiction. But there's nothing to stop Kenya, Sudan, or anybody to exercise that court. So they were arguing that, well, why then should we create a court which would have less power than what we already have? So they didn't see the justification for that. Now, of course, the actual deliberations that we all know, the U.S., actually, the chief delegate of the U.S. left, thinking that the meeting would be adjourned, but it was the EU countries that insisted that the vote should go on. So it was really the U.S. allies that said, no, we have to vote. So then, of course, the vote was that it was overwhelming. There were only six countries that were against the creation of a court, and that is, you know, the U.S., and people point out that, you know, they were in a company which they really wouldn't want to be, you know, Iraq and Somalia, you know, I mean, it's no state. So it's really quite embarrassing in terms of the company, of course, for that. Now, so then let's come to the statute is created. One of the things, of course, the U.S. did, because they wanted to slow the implementation of the court, is to, and you do this a lot. I mean, I worked in treaty making in trade, and when you lose your arguments with countries, what you do is you put the ratification number very high. You know, ratification number is the number which you need for a treaty to come into force. So if you look at, for example, non-proliferation, you only needed 3, and then it's law. But the International Criminal Court needed 60. And that was the idea was, well, they're not going to get this, so it will not come into force. And of course, to everybody's surprise, that was attained within 2 years. And the court did, in fact, come into force. So it is now in place, and the court is in is of course in The Hague. Now, I try to show first, the most important thing to remember about the court is that the court is complementary. It exercises what we call complementary jurisdiction. That is distinguished from what, say, for example, the Rwanda court or the Yugoslav court. The Yugoslav court has primary, you know, jurisdiction, which means that if they want a case, no country can touch that case. You know, you have to give it to Yugoslavia. And that happened, in fact, in the case of Germany, for example. There was a case Germany was actually handling, and Yugoslavia said, we want it. So they took it. The same with Rwanda. So the primary. The ICC doesn't have that. ICC is complementary. The ICC jurisdiction is only exercised where the national state is not exercising that jurisdiction. So you can stop the prosecutions there because you are going to prosecute the individuals in your own jurisdiction. So it is complementary. That's an important point to make. So then, in terms of substantive jurisdiction, so you look at what crimes, that's what we mean by substantive jurisdiction. What crimes does it handle? The ICC handles only those crimes there, the genocide, aggression, and serious violations of the law and customs applicable to armed conflict, and then crimes against humanity, so there are four or five crimes, basically. Now, the crimes are codified in the ICC, in those sections, in the Article 6, 7, 5, 8. You find that there is like a penal code. Now, in fact, of course, the ICC could also have said, we don't need to codify, because the view of international lawyers is that, in fact, these crimes are already crimes, you know, under customary international law. And that's why Nuremberg was able to try those crimes, because they're already crimes. So it's not new. In fact, ICC, in that sense, has less than the Nuremberg. Because, you see, aggression. If you look at the Nuremberg trial, there were a lot of charges of aggression, you know, and they were going on. Now, with the ICC, they could not agree in Rome on a definition of aggression. So what they have done is that they have a provision there which says that the crime of aggression will become a crime under the ICC when the conference, the ICC conference agrees on a definition. So it's at the moment in that situation where you cannot actually charge somebody for aggression in the ICC because they cannot agree on the definition, but they're waiting for the definition to be concluded. Now, one of the things that might happen, of course, next year, or is it, I think next year, there's going to be the first review conference of the ICC. All the member states are meeting in Uganda to review progress and also look at whether they need amendments to this treaty. So it's the first opportunity to revisit the statute. So we see then that, genocide, I think, you know, we don't need to go into definitions because we spent a lot of time, you know, with our technical definitions in terms of the difference between genocide and murder. Of course, it's specific intent. That is killing a whole race. You don't have to achieve it, but that's the point about genocide. Now, in terms of the third category, this is actually the war crimes. Now, the war crimes are actually created by the Geneva Conventions. There are four of them, and they were concluded after the war. And the idea of the Geneva Conventions is, of course, that war is bad, but if you're going to fight, then you must fight in a civilized way. So I don't know whether it's possible to fight in a civilized way, but that's the idea, basically. So what does it do? It punishes certain types of behavior. For example, using weapons which excessively kill civilians. Of course, it also says you shouldn't kill prisoners of war, you shouldn't torture, you shouldn't do all that. So it is really how you conduct the war and the weapons and how you treat the people that you capture. So it's all about having this a good way of fighting. Yeah. So this is why you hear, for example, in the context of Iraq, there's this discussion about treatment of prisoners and the way the question of use of torture, and you also hear about Guantanamo, why the government doesn't want you to classify those people as a war prisoners, because of course then the Geneva Conventions become applicable. But if you say they are enemy combatants, then they are not, then you can do other things, you see. So that's the distinction. They are always arguing that, no, these guys are not war criminals. Because if you admit that they're war criminals, then of course Geneva Conventions come into play, Red Cross must have access. You must in terms of prisoners, just ask them their name, their rank, and then keep them until there's an agreement to exchange the prisoners. So that's the whole concept. Now, on the second line, I tried to show that actually when you look at for example, the Yugos Tribunal and others, they also had the modifications, you know, in terms of the substantive laws. But that's actually the main. Now, those are the main crimes. So I think the next thing that we need to look at then is really the question of how the ICC exercises its jurisdiction. How does it get a case? Now, I think that basically the ICC gets its jurisdiction in two ways. Yeah, there. How does it get jurisdiction? And then, of course, we've got real examples. Like, how did they get jurisdiction over Bashir? Because Sudan is not a member of the ICC. And yet, they are exercising jurisdiction over Bashir. So how did it happen? So there are two ways in which the ICC gets a case. First is what we call referral by the Security Council, which means that the whole process is initiated by the Security Council. Now, the example of that is Bashir. The Bashir case was not initiated by the ICC, and that's a mistake. Those that say ICC did this. The Security Council passed a resolution and asked the ICC to investigate. They gave the ICC 53 names, actually, of people they want to be investigated in Sudan. And of course, that's how the process started. Now, at the time when there was this referral, there was in fact a very major difference between the US and the other countries. The US was for a special tribunal. They wanted to create a special tribunal for Sudan. But the other countries said, we have the ICC, we don't need special tribunals anymore. And in fact, that was the position of France, that was the position of the UK in the Security Council. And in order to allow the process to go forward, because the US wanted prosecutions to go on, but did not want the ICC. So what they did is they abstained. They didn't vote. And that allowed the, because if they had voted, that would have been a veto. And the process would not have gone forward. So this, the US actually just abstained and allowed the process. So that's how the ICC got the case. Now, it's important to remember here that when there's a referral by the Security Council, you don't need to be a member of the ICC. That is irrelevant. And that's why they are able to refer the case of Sudan. Sudan is not today a member of the ICC. So now, the other way it can exercise jurisdiction is there, which we call prosecutorial initiative. The prosecutor can actually initiate. He can say, or she can say to the court, I think we should look at this case. Now, of course, here there was a lot of concern that if the prosecutor has this power, then of course there's the problem that you will get abuse. So built into that process, when the prosecutor initiates the investigation, it has to go to a three-chamber tribunal where he or she makes a case. And the tribunal will then come out and say, okay, there's a prima facie case. That on the face of it, it looks like you have a case, so you can go ahead. So he has to get permission. Now, the other way that the ICC gets the cases is through referral by a state. That is a member state now. Because it's not the Security Council, so it has to be a member state. And this is how they got the Ugandan case. Because Uganda, and contrary to what some people say, Uganda is the one that initiated the process against Kony. They went to the ICC and said, please, come, we want you to try these guys. The same with the Congo over Lubango. They went to the ICC and said, help us, we need this guy tried. So that's another way that now the precondition, of course, with the referral by estate is that you have actually to be, you know, a member of the ICC. That means that as a state, you ought to have ratified. Now, there are preconditions for the state referral and also for the prosecutor's initiative, and that is that where the crime happens, it needs to be a member state, or the perpetrator needs to be a national of a member state. So you can refer a case as Uganda, like in the Kony case, because of course you're a member. Now you could also refer the case because Kony is a national of Uganda. So you could not refer a case that happens elsewhere. So now, this again is an issue which the Americans took up. And they were, you know, I'm sure you've heard about how, oh, they don't want the court to try Americans and that kind of thing. And I would argue that that's just a, you know, a fallacious reason they give. Because, you see, the point is this. Right now, jurisdiction of states over criminal matters does not depend on nationality. I'm not an American, but if I commit a crime here, the U.S. has jurisdiction over me because it's location, it's territorial, it's where you are. So if you, an American, commits a crime in France, they will not excuse you and say that you're an American. So it actually happens. So what's the argument then, you know, in terms of the court trying Americans? They can do it because national courts can do it. So why shouldn't a new court do? That's one of the arguments that is raised. So those are the ways in which the court exercises jurisdiction. Now, of course, the other issue that comes up, and we see this as we go on to look at the AU, is this question of stopping a trial by the Security Council. Under Article 16 of the statutes of the court, the Security Council can ask the court to defer an ongoing case. So like, for example, if somebody is charged, like in the case of Bashir, the Security Council can actually ask the court to say, okay, for 1 year, don't do anything. And there's no limit which suggests that this deferral can go on forever. But the good thing about the way they structured the legislation is that you have to make a positive decision to request. So it's not possible. A veto is useless in this context because a veto is negative. So if you want to get a deferral, you have to get a majority to raise a resolution which then asks the court to do that. So that's, and the arguments, of course, are that, you know, this would give space to the Security Council, you know, to maybe they are dealing with the matter in other ways. There's that problem. Now, let's come then to the question of the court and Africa, because I think that's a lot of the what I, here I try to explain this question of territorial and all that. Now, the question of the court and Africa, I don't see that. What's happened to? Supposed to be next to this. Maybe it's not there. I thought, it's right on top, I think. Sorry. Yeah, I think it came up. Okay, yeah. Sorry, thanks. Yeah, so let's look then at the court and Africa. Well, first, as I think you've seen from my, my presentation, I take issue with the argument that the court is focusing on Africa because there's no evidence for that. Why do I say that? Because they're not handling a single case on Africa, which has been their own initiative. They have 5 cases from Africa, and in each one of those cases, the African states have gone to the ICC. The only one, Sudan, Security Council, went to the ICC. So where is the evidence that, in fact, the court sitting out there is actually targeting Africa? I don't see it. Because I would like to see a case which actually is in the court right now and has been initiated by the court and is on Africa. There's none. So now in July 2008, the AU has been very critical of the ICC lately, and this is in relation to Sudan. So in 2008, they established this high-level panel. Now, the high-level panel was established as a reaction to the indictment of Bashir, because the AU felt that Bashir should not be indicted as a head of state, as a sitting head of state. Now, the high-level panel was headed by Mbeki. They met, and in the end, they recommended that what should happen is that there should be a hybrid court system in Sudan to try the people that are alleged to have committed crimes, international crimes. Now, as Salah mentioned, I was actually appointed to this panel, and did participate in a limited way. I couldn't really continue because they wanted to be in Darfur for 40 days. In other words, doing all these town hall meetings. So when you are committed elsewhere, like we are teaching and all that, it becomes very difficult to do that sort of thing. And I think Tio Malua too, who another colleague of mine from Penn State who also was on it, found the same kind of difficulty that for these other guys, they had the time to do it, but we couldn't. But we participated, you know, in documentation and the earlier meetings. So, I think my argument would be that the hybrid system that is recommended by the panel recommends hybrid system, recommends truth commission, and sort of like a political solution to the crisis. But it also does say that there shouldn't be any impunity. So, of course, they agree on the prosecutions, but they are saying it should be the hybrid. But I think I would agree with the Human Rights Watch, which observes that the hybrid panel would be useful, but I don't think that it should be a replacement for the ICC, because I'm yet to be convinced why, you know, there shouldn't be a process in the ICC. Because to me, the argument is not the indictment of Bashir. The argument should be framed in the context of, has Bashir committed crimes? Because if he has committed crimes, then I think the law should take its course. But if he hasn't, of course there shouldn't be. And to me, it shouldn't be the focus of an individual. It's the focus of have the crimes happened. If they have, then I think we know the solution. If they haven't, again, we should then, of course, defend him, that he shouldn't be prosecuted. Now, I mentioned there that one of the other things that the AU has done is call for a deferral, that is asking the Security Council to use Article 16 to defer the trial. And so far, they've been unsuccessful. In fact, I think the story is that the Security Council has actually refused to have meetings with the AU on this issue. Then, of course, on July 3, in Libya, the AU passed a resolution in which it said that it was calling on African states not to honor the warrants that have been issued, because COMPOS has issued warrants on Bashir. So they asked that they shouldn't honor these warrants. And they, of course, also attacked the independence of the court, making the allegations that the court is targeting Africa and all that. And as I say, for me, I think that's misplaced, because there's no evidence that, in fact, that is so, because they didn't initiate the process. And I think you are attacking the wrong person. You should attack the Security Council for doing what they did, if you disagree with the referral. Now, they said that African countries should not cooperate. And I think that, in my view, that is the wrong approach, because if you join a treaty, there are treaty obligations. Either get out of the treaty or carry out the obligations of the treaty. So you can't say you stay in the ICC and then don't carry out the obligations. And I think those points have actually been made, because there has been dissent. As I point out, Botswana, for example, issued a very strong statement and said that they're not going to be party to this AU position, because they don't see why the work of the ICC should be undermined simply because they're trying one individual. So we should have other solutions. And of course, South Africa, which was thought to be going along initially, has come out very, very strongly against the AU position, and has actually said that, according to them, that the arrest warrant in South Africa has been processed because it was filed with the magistrate, and they are saying that if Bashir does come to South Africa, they will execute the warrant, that it's the law, and therefore they will do that. And they, of course, they added that their own constitution is based on values of human rights, and that they cannot therefore be party to a process which tries to undermine this process. The other thing I'd like to bring out is that here are the cases that the AU has on Africa. And as I was show you, all of them have actually been taken there by the countries. Kenya is the latest. Kenya went to the ICC and said, please come and try the people that committed the violence after the elections. So there's really no evidence that there's any case that has been initiated in The Hague. I would also like to show that actually in terms of personnel, it's a very interesting position that the ICC has actually very strong African representation in terms of the judges. Africa has the second highest number of judges on the court, more than Latin America, which has four, more than Asia, which has two, more than Eastern Europe, which has two, almost equal to Europe and the others, which has six. Africa has five, and the rest, Europe and Australia and the others, they have six. So they have a very strong presence in terms of personnel. And then, of course, also in terms of the prosecutor, the deputy prosecutor is actually, and those are the figures I tried to show you, the deputy prosecutor is an African, a woman from Gambia. And she has been very, very vocal in terms of the work of the prosecutor. So in terms of personnel, I would argue that if you compare other international institutions, the representation of Africa in the ICC is actually quite good at very high levels. The president of the appeals chamber is actually Judge Nsereko from Uganda. And Daniel Nsereko. The warrant on Bashir, the process was actually chaired by Akua Kwehaimia from Ghana. She's the one that actually even issued the warrant from the ICC. So it's been really African judges that have been very, very active in the process in the ICC. So I think then I will try to conclude. So I think what I've been trying to explain then is that, the court is really a product of a long process of trying to make people who engage in war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity accountable. It is a process that is now in place, and we are not likely to see any more special courts because there's now resistance to create special courts. Because countries are arguing that we now have a permanent court and we don't need any more Yugoslav tribunal, Rwanda tribunal. Now, of course, there's a very strong argument that can be made for hybrid tribunals. One of the major problems, I think, with a process like the ICC is the distance between where these crimes are happening and where the court is. And I think that's the big advantage that you have when you have special courts, if they are then located in the theater where the crimes happened. As it is, of course, it means that you go to, you go to The Hague. Now, you might ask a question as to what do they do with kind of like prisoners, you know? Now, that's interesting. And I think that one of the contradictions of the process is that actually the tribunals and the ICC are sort of like trying the big guys. And then in the end, of course, the ICC has no physical buildings to put these people in prison. So they contract out. And most of these people convicted out of Yugoslavia or out of Rwanda, they're actually serving sentences in Scandinavian countries. And if you're going to be in prison, I think that's where you should be, you know, because obviously the conditions are much better. But then the lower ranked people are being tried by domestic courts, like even the Rwanda situation, and then they go to these really bad prisons. So you really have this problem that emerges. So I think I'll stop there and then, you know, open up for discussion. I look forward to hearing your views and, you know, I'll try to respond as well as I can do. But as you can see from my presentation, I am a strong supporter of the court and the process that the court. Asian.
So Asia, very low when we compare.
Yeah.
When you talk about people and population. Asia. Question number two. Clarify for me, please.
Sorry?
Clarify another thing for me. When the United States went into Panama, was it? And Captain Noriega brought him back, tried him under US courts. Is that tolerated in any way by concepts or precepts of international law?
Yeah, Asia, well, the I think it's the it's a political problem in that the judges are elected by the General Assembly. So the matter of numbers would have to be sorted out in the context of the General Assembly. So at the moment, this is how they've been voting. The last time they made new judges, I think it was last year. That's when they elected Sanji from Botswana. And they there were some Asian candidates, but they did not get high votes to qualify. So in the end, they lost their, So I think that's really a matter for the General Assembly in terms of the Asians should complain, you know, and then, of course, negotiate somehow in terms of getting their judges appointed, yeah. The Noriega matter, I think that you see Noriega, if you look at the charges, I mean, of course, there are problems in terms of the way Noriega was captured. Now, the US courts take the position that they don't really worry about how you're brought into the US. Once you come in, they'll try you. That's what they say. And they did this, remember, in the Mexican case where it went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, you know, yeah, we don't really get into how you came here, you can be kidnapped, you can be anything. Now, that's not the position of all countries in the world. I mean, for example, in South African jurisdiction, lots of cases, if you are kidnapped, the South African courts say no, because they say that, you know, you must come to, the prosecution must come to court with clean hands, you know, and they don't want this kind of process. Australia also has that. So it depends on the jurisdiction. And that's really a local matter in terms of the US law, Australian law, British law. Now, Noriega was never charged with international crimes. You see. So he's not charged with any of those five. And that's the only time that it becomes, because international crime, then of course there's international jurisdiction. But the US charged Noriega for violating US laws. You know, drugs, this and that, you know. But it was all, now you can argue about that, you know, but that's how they proceeded. So for them, it was completely an American issue, American law, American courts, so the international system was not involved. Now, you might ask the question, how does a particular type of conduct become an international crime? I think it's a labeling process. Torture became an international crime because we have the Torture Convention. States sat down, they then concluded the convention and declared it an international crime. So they can declare anything. In fact, there's a lot of discussion about human trafficking, that maybe they should do that. Now, of course, there's discussion about terrorism. Terrorism is not an international crime. And that's because, of course, like aggression, they can't agree on the definition. You know, one nation's terrorist is another nation's liberator. So you have these problems. But it's a labeling process. The international community would have to agree and designate that particular type of conduct as international. And then the courts of jurisdiction, in terms of international courts.
Okay, I have a question.
Mm-hmm. One is a clarification. The question of Belgium, for example. Belgium is an exception because
There is the case of like Kissinger cannot talk.
Yeah, very, yeah.
And
yeah.
Several people who are accused of war crimes, for example. And it was also possible, because I know the case against Sharon, and now against Libby recently. It was actually brought by a woman, a Palestinian woman, that prevented actually Sharon canceled his visit there. Of course, it collapsed after that. But
yeah. Yeah.
So I wonder why Belgium is that kind of like that?
Yeah, well.
Why is it possible, for example, that for an Iraqi to come to the United States and complain against Bush, for example?
Oh, okay. Well, I think I made the point that you have universal jurisdiction. So, the question was, why is Belgium able to do what it's doing? Belgium is indicting a lot of people in its courts. For example, Sharon, they've said they will indict Kissinger too. They've said, they have all these warrants. Individuals. There's actually a very simple explanation for this. And that is that, you see, all countries have universal jurisdiction. So any country in the world, that's a fundamental norm in international law, they have universal jurisdiction. What does it mean? Universal jurisdiction means that for certain time crimes, that is for international crimes, a state has jurisdiction regardless of the perpetrator, where it happened, and who was the victim. Because usually you get jurisdiction because it happens territorially in your country, or it's a national. But universal jurisdiction says you can have jurisdiction regardless, but only for those five. So that explains why Spain had jurisdiction over Pinochet, because Pinochet didn't commit those tortures in Spain. And Spain was arguing that they have jurisdiction because of universal jurisdiction. So every country can do that. The difference between Belgium and other countries is that you need, international law needs domestic implementing legislation. Because you see, when you go to court, the first thing a judge will ask you is that, okay, you're bringing this court case, show me that I have jurisdiction. He wants to know, or she wants to know. And you have to be able to say, yes, this provision of the Constitution authorizes you to do that. So U.S. has not passed legislation to authorize U.S. courts to implement universal jurisdiction. Belgium, on the other hand, has done so. It has passed this very liberal legislation, and it sees itself as doing this on behalf of the world. In fact, we're getting more and more countries. The UK recently passed legislation. It's not as broad as the Belgian one, but it did. Spain has such legislation. Now, the question of why an individual can bring a prosecution is a matter for systems of law. You see, under the common law system, like here, you have the district attorney like in charge of prosecutions, and they initiate the prosecutions and all that. In the civil law system, judges can initiate prosecutions. So people go and file a complaint with a judge, like happened with Pinochet. They went to a judge actually in a small town in Spain, and then the judge issues a warrant, and that's enough to start the process. You wouldn't do that in the UK because of the common law system that, you do need, the state has established offices which actually look at this and then they initiate all these prosecutions. But in the other places, it's liberal. You can do that. But the key thing is that you have legislation. And Belgium has, of course, as you know, convicted the first case they used this legislation was what is called the Butare 4. The four nuns who were convicted in Belgium for genocide in Rwanda, and they never committed those crimes in Belgium, and Belgium did not claim that they did anything wrong in Belgium, but they happened to have been in Belgium, and they had the warrants, and they're in jail in Belgium because of that. So you can do that, but only with those five crimes. Now, they've had some problems. As you know, Belgium tried to indict the Congolese foreign minister. They issued a warrant for his arrest and then sent them around countries saying that if you see this guy, please arrest him, which is the same as Pinochet. Now, this matter, of course, the Congo then went up to the ICJ and complained that Belgium was harassing the Congolese government and that it was also not dignified to be doing things like this. Now, it provided an opportunity which is interesting and is relevant to the Bashir case. Because in the case of the Congo, the ICJ made a distinction that there's a distinction between trials that are going to be conducted by international tribunals and domestic courts. And they said that a head of state, a serving head of state, which would apply to Bashir, Belgium cannot do that. They have to wait until he leaves office. But an international tribunal, you cannot, because there you are claiming immunity, and immunity is a norm of international law, and of course the tribunal is international, so it's not, you cannot be controlled by those kind of things. So with respect to an international tribunal, there is no immunity. You can be arrested even when you are serving head of state. And that was the same defense Taylor raised, because Taylor said that, first of all, he was the head of state, but not only that, that the Accra Agreement, under which he gave up power, gave him immunity. And it's true. If you read that agreement, it says, we will not prosecute you if you give up power, okay? But the International Court of Justice has said, no, nobody can give immunity to international crimes. So this is useless. So they've refused to honor that process. You can give immunity with domestic law. The international courts will not pay any attention to that. And that's the position. And now Belgium, of course, has been going after. He sent this guy, the Chad guy, the guy who came from Habre, who is now in Senegal. And they've indicted him, too. And they want him in Belgium for trial. But of course, then Senegal said, no, we are going to try him. And of course, the ICJ said that, okay, Senegal should be given a chance to do that first. Yes, please. I'll come to you then. Yeah. Yes.
In electing the representative, non-permanent representative to the Security Council, each region goes through a process. Mm-hmm.
The judges.
What are the criteria?
Yeah, well, the judges actually campaign. I mean, there are lawyers that want to be on that court. So they usually go to their governments to nominate them. And then they start speaking to regional blocs, you know, that support us. And then, of course, when they go to the General Assembly, they support these regional candidates as such. Eh? And that's how they win. So there's a lot of campaigning, just like the ICJ. I mean, you hear that so-and-so is running for the court, and they go around. But the key is to get country support. Now, of course, as a lot of trading goes on, because they might say, the Africans might say, you know what, to Europe, if you support this candidate, we're going to support yours too. You know, so, of course, that way you get people elected. So it's a lot of that going on. Yeah. That would mean Ireland trying to exercise universal jurisdiction. Yeah, because that's one of the things that, of course, this new found, enthusiasm to arrest people for international crimes is that it has impacted on the travel of a lot of people. I mean, for example, Kissinger definitely doesn't really feel safe to go to Europe because, you see, one of the problems is that once, say you go to Germany, and the courts issue an order, the government cannot help you. Because if they do, they'll be seen to be interfering in the judiciary. So you have to take protective measures yourself, because that's what happened to Pinochet. The British government didn't like the idea that Pinochet was arrested in Britain. I think that they preferred that it didn't happen. But they had no choice once it had happened, because if the politicians interfered with the courts, then of course, you know, It's like, wow, there's no independence of the judiciary. You know, you're interfering. So you have to avoid getting caught, because if you do, then really you are in some kind of trouble in terms of time and defending yourself. Yeah. And you don't know which warrants are out, because what we know is that a lot of the human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch has a division which keeps files, and they say that. Amnesty International is doing the same. If you look at the case of Pinochet, all the files were from Human Rights Watch. Yeah.
So why didn't the ICC didn't keep the warrants secret? They could have caught a machine.
They could what?
Why didn't they keep the warrant secret?
No, they have to announce the warrant once you indict somebody.
No.
What I'm saying is that in the case of the Pinochet case, they did not apply to the British government until he was actually in the UK. You know, they were looking for what they call friendly jurisdiction, for you to be where they can do those kind of things. Because if Pinochet came here and they filed, the US government, you know, probably not cooperate. So they tried to look for these jurisdictions. Yes, please. Yeah.
Well, I have a friend from Zambia whose initials are MN, who I recommend for ICC.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Okay. All right. My question is this. I think you've made the case.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. That Africa is not being picked up on.
Yeah, that's the.
I think you made that very clearly.
Yeah.
Moreover, Bush too. Colin Powell and Kofi Annan stated that genocide was occurring in Sudan. What's the problem? Who's saying, the question is this, who's saying that Africa is being picked upon by anyone?
No, the AU, in their resolution.
The AU. All right.
In their resolution, they did say that. That they said that.
That's also Gaddafi's organization.
Gaddafi. Yeah, but there have been sentiments by African scholars that have been picked up. But what I'm saying is that if you look at the cases, there are five from Africa.
Sure.
None of them were initiated by the court. So where is the evidence? That's what I'm asking.
You know,
I don't see the evidence. Maybe in future, but right now, I don't see the case. Because Kenya, for example, in the Kenyan case, two Americans filed briefs to try and prevent the process. And the Kenyan government was mad with them. They actually denounced the two professors, because they were saying that the ICC was interfering in the internal affairs of Kenya. And the Kenyan said, no, we asked the court to come. Now, you might ask, why is Kenya doing that? Well, it's a perception by Kenyans that they don't trust their own judiciary to deal with these cases, because there's a tension in the country. So they want somebody else to deal with this problem. So it's a conscious decision they've made.
You know, I just don't want to be monopolizing it, but it's a point that's really important. Yes, we can agree with you that Africa was not picked up, just by evidence, you think. But from the other side, the argument has been, which is almost the argument that dictators posed, is the double standard internationally. That all of these things don't apply to Israel.
That's right.
I mean, like why? I mean, why is it not possible for the ICC to take a case like the recent Gaza incursions and its clear violations? Goldstone case made it so clear that this is a crime against humanity. He has a judge with grave integrity of Jewish background, you know, came out publicly against
Yeah.
And the U.S. is also one case where it's not possible. So what about the double standard argument?
Well, the case of Israel, actually, the answer is quite simple in terms of the ICC. The ICC will tell you that Israel is not a member of the ICC. So the only way they can have jurisdiction is Security Council. And of course, the US is going to veto that. So it's not a problem of the ICC, really, because Israel has not joined the ICC. And if you look at the jurisdiction, you have to be a member for them to, for the state to refer, or a national of that. The only way, so Israel is in the same situation as Sudan, because Sudan is not a member. So the ICC could not exercise jurisdiction in Sudan, but the only way they were able to is Security Council moved in and they referred the situation. So if you can get the Security Council to refer the Gaza situation to the ICC, they will have the jurisdiction. But right now, legally, they can't, because Israel is not going to join the court.
So then political power and political muscle play a role. That's
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that it's more of a technical, it's true that you have power because, of course, the U.S., but if you look at the process, you then, the person you should be blaming is the Security Council, isn't it? Not the court, because the court is handicapped. There's nothing it can do, actually, because according to the laws of the court, it can only exercise jurisdiction if the preconditions are met. Where a state is not a member, only the Security Council can refer those cases to. And they can do that, and that's what they've done in Sudan. So the Security Council is the body to blame for no action. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes, please.
Well, my question is actually about Kenya and the CAR cases and why they're being referred to the court rather than prosecuted domestically. But I think you spoke to that.
Okay. Yeah, I know a little bit about the Kenyan process because... I mean, luckily, I've been involved in Kenya these last 2 years in the constitutional process, and I went there immediately after the violence, and I've just come back from there. I was there last week. There's very strong feeling in Kenya that there were crimes against humanity committed, you know, that violence was used deliberately to cleanse certain areas of certain tribes. So this is generally, you know, kind of the position. There's also the problem that the Kenyans don't trust the Kenyan judiciary. And this is very evident even in the constitutional making process. I was there, and I mean, last week we concluded this draft now, which is going to parliament. And there's a provision there that the judges are all going to be vetted. They don't want the current judges. They say that they have to pass a test to see that, you know, they will subject them to tribunals and then investigate because they say they are corrupt, they are biased, they are pro-government, so they don't believe. In fact, when there was the dispute over the elections, Oginga, who many believe won, refused to go to court because he said, no, we don't trust these courts, they will rule for the government. So they don't want to use the local courts. So this is a conscious decision that they need some outsider to kind of clean up the system, and then later on they can proceed. So I think the answer is really that they are convinced nationally that they don't want to use Kenyan courts. Well, yeah, I would think that it's an unfortunate use in the sense that it's very expensive, you know, because trials in Kenya would be much cheaper than trials in The Hague, and witnesses would be transported there, so there are a lot of costs. But of course, they believe that they weighed this against, you know, what could happen if, in fact, these things happen in Kenya. So that's so the Kenyans are very, it has very strong support within Kenya in terms of the, and interestingly, when I was there last week, I mean, the Obama's envoy on genocide, which is interesting because he was busy giving press conferences in Kenya about how the court is doing wonderful things and that this process must go on. And he's actually saying on March 15, the court will announce indictment of three people from Kenya. I don't know how he knows, but then it's interesting because the U.S. doesn't support the ICC. But in Kenya, they are like, oh, this is the right way to go. You know, so it's a very interesting. Yes, please.
Just one comment on the Israel thing, I've had a question. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm asking that because the universal jurisdiction cases that were brought by former colonizers against their former colonies were charged with this big issue of neocolonialism.
Yeah.
So that colonialism is actually perpetuated now also by jurisdictional ties.
Mm-hmm.
And can we make some sort of, or do we have some kind of historical intuition whether the ICC might be a solution or another body that might alleviate the problem of jurisdictional neocolonialism or not?
Yeah, yeah. The only problem, of course, with the ICC jurisdiction is that it's from the date of They can't try anything that happened before. And that, again, was a decision by states. So if you bring cases that happened before the court was created, the court is prevented from hearing those things.